You're listening to the Story of Woman podcast with Lindsay Hansen Park. When you think of human development, you think of humans progressing forward, learning new technologies, inventing new things, new ideas, and becoming more and more complex. I mean, that's kind of the way it happens, right? Along with evolution, human ideas evolve and they build one upon another. And then we learn new things about ourselves and about the earth and about systems around us and those around us. And inevitably with that comes people who also learn how to exploit that information and learn how to gain power and access to it. That's what we're going to talk about today. Would you ever think that some of the world's biggest social inequalities, like, say, slavery, human trafficking, abuse, misogyny, sexism, homophobia, all of that could come from a single seed? And I don't just mean metaphorically, I mean physically, like an actual seed. You see, many scholars are starting to identify that the birth of inequality started with a single seed, or rather the domestication of a single seed. All of this happens in what we know as the agricultural revolution. There's a term that comes out of the agricultural revolution, and it's stratification. And stratification is sort of a system by which society is able to rank its members in a hierarchy. And we see this everywhere. In almost every single society, there's hierarchy. There's a leader at the top, and then there's people below. All societies stratify their members. And when you stratify your members, there's unequal distribution of society's rewards and resources because people are arranged in sort of this hierarchy into layers according to what that society values and what society deems each person on the hierarchical ladder to be worthy of, how much power they are assigned and what they possess. I've been studying feminist theory for a while now, and Marxist theory, and anyone that knows anything about these power systems, hierarchies, social systems, we understand stratification. We see it working in our own lives, and we try to unpack it in other systems, in other societies as well. To understand stratification, we need to understand its origins. There are some scholars that say that hunter-gatherer societies had no stratification, even though it was quite clear that there is a division of labor. It's generally thought that men hunted and women gathered, even though that's sort of a little biased, sexist idea to look at how early humans worked. Even though there was a division of labor, it was generally thought that both men and women cared for the children equally. They both saw them as equal part of the group, equal responsibility, and they cared for them equally. Historically, whether or not hunter-gatherer societies can be defined as socially stratified, or if social stratification began with agriculture and these sort of common acts of social exchange, is still debated a lot in social academia. Another word for the agricultural revolution is the Neolithic revolution, or the Neolithic demographic transition. And basically, it's this huge transition in human culture from the lifestyle of the hunting and gathering to one of settling down and staying in one place and farming. And of course, by doing so, it allows the land to support an increase of population. If you're gathering and living this sort of nomadic lifestyle, you have your little band of people and you're moved from place to place according to the resources. Because you have to find resources. You can't stay where there are no resources. But if you learn to make resources where you are, then it allows for societies to grow and grow. Your band can get bigger because it doesn't have to travel. You can stay and more people can come. And generally, it sounds like a better idea, right? Settled communities allowed human beings to stay put and experiment with things and learn how to grow and develop. This new knowledge would free up all sorts of things. But whether the agricultural revolution's effects were net positive, it's still up for debate. When we discovered how to farm, we finally figured out how to have the planet work for us, not the other way around. We started to manipulate the land. Because of that, we all subsist on byproducts of the agricultural revolution. It's easy to sit here and say, oh, you know, the Neolithic revolution started inequality, started sexism, this is why we have patriarchy. But it's not that simple, just like anything else is. And we do benefit largely from the byproducts of the agricultural revolution. Our ancestors would have been very familiar with the land and how it worked. They would grow up for generations and generations paying attention to the earth around them. Their survival depended on it. It would make sense that they would watch what would happen if they were gathering some nuts or seeds, and they saw what happened to leftover seeds on the ground. You don't have to be a genius to know that as you're gathering seeds, the seeds you don't gather left in the ground grow. People that hunted and gathered couldn't produce nearly enough food that the farmers could, and they couldn't produce storable food either. So as they're gathering, they still are paying attention. They got really good at this. They had done this for generations and generations and generations. And they're paying attention to the land. Something that's interesting to note, some people place the responsibility, the blame, the credit, whatever you want to call it, of the agricultural revolution squarely on the shoulders of women. It's said that women played a critical role in the agricultural revolution. Here's what Elise Boulding, a scholar who kind of develops this idea, says about women in the agricultural revolution. Quote, "Successful nomads have had a much easier life than do farmers. Among the Kung Bushmen today, the men hunt about 4 days a week and the women only need to work 2.5 days at gathering to feed their families. What was it like once the band settled down? This is almost from the first start a woman's world. She would mark out the fields for planting because she knew where the grain would grow best. The agricultural practice by these first women farmers and their children produced enough food for subsistence only. It must be distinguished from the agriculture which developed out of subsistence farming and which produced surpluses and fed non-farming populations in towns. The first type is commonly called horticulture and is carried out with hand tools only. The second is agriculture proper and involves intensive cultivation with the use of plows and, where necessary, irrigation. Women also began to spend more time on making tools and containers. No longer needing to hold the family possessions down to what they could carry, women could luxuriate in being able to choose larger and heavier grinding stones to crush grains more effectively. The senior women of the family and her daughters and sons formed the property-holding unit of the family." End quote. According to Boulding's analysis, women probably played a crucial role in the agricultural revolution because they were the original seed breeders. Since they were the gatherers, the men would focus their time on hunting, women were gathering the grain. It also illustrates the change that the agricultural revolution created in society. Divisions of labor between men and women would have only increased. This would have given women more power, especially as they became identified with fertility, and leisure time would have decreased. So then time became a valued commodity, and this would also lead to the increase. The less time you had to do things, the more time you wanted to give it to others, so you would have more leisure time for yourself. Now, if women really were the ones paying attention to the seeds, since they handled the seeds and grain so much, it is very possible that the first domestication of plants come or could be credited to women. Now, scholars used to think that maybe agriculture or farming came out of one place, and now they know that's not true because they've found dig sites all over the world that show that it was happening near the same point in human evolution. We know in the Middle East, they grew two kinds of cereal grasses, barley and wheat. In China, they grew rice. In the Americas, corn, squash, and beans. And later Africa developed farming as well. In the areas of the world that were able to domesticate plants, we see the rise of cooperative societies and later advanced societies. To understand this idea of complex societies or advanced societies, I had the honor of sitting down with renowned archaeologist Winifred Kramer, who has studied pre-Columbian societies, meaning societies that are older than the Mayans. Winifred's research has primarily been in Peru, unlocking the mysteries of the ancient people, the Norte Chico. Now, the Norte Chico isn't something we usually hear about. We like to hear in the Americas, we hear about the Mayans and the Incans and sort of this exotic ancient world. But long before them, there were people doing the work and developing advanced societies. When we talked in some of our last episodes, we talked about Paleo-Indians, sort of the hunter-gatherers of the Americas, and the things that they were doing. We know that in the ancient American world, there were complex trade systems developing. Even though there were hunter-gatherers, people were traveling long distances. People in Minnesota were seen with shells that came from Florida. So we know that people were traveling and developing systems of trade. But I'm going to let Dr. Kramer talk about her work with the Norte Chico and kind of understand this inequality and how complex societies develop. I had a fantastic interview with her, but our audio isn't great. She was Skyping in from Spain, and so it's a little choppy at times, but it's definitely worth a listen.
Okay, my name's Winifred Kramer. I'm an archaeologist. I taught for 25 years at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois, where I was part of the anthropology department. My interests are pretty broad, but they are the development of complex society as well as people in the New World, meaning North and South America.
I'm so happy to have you on. So we've been talking before on previous episodes about Paleo-Indians and hunter-gatherers and maybe the troubling way in which we engage in the subject and how we have looked at the groups in the past. But I want you to kind of explain to us the concept of complex societies and what those mean.
One of the fundamental differences is the development of institutions, that you go from people living in units that are the same. A band of hunters and gatherers is largely the same wherever you find it. I mean, the ages of people may vary, but it includes the whole spectrum of ages and family units in a very, very general sense. When you talk about complex society, you talk about people who have gotten together and have different occupations and where there is more noticeable inequality, particularly, you know, everyone has inequality. There's inequality based on age, gender, and ability. But what we're talking about with complex society is people who have status that other people don't have. And one of the fundamental questions is, how does that come about? If everybody lives on the same landscape and does roughly the same thing, how can it be that some people eventually develop wealth and power? Then the study of complex society tries to answer those questions.
So I find this interesting because, like I said in previous episodes, we were talking about Paleo-Indians. And I'm also interested in sort of the intersection of inequality, because in studying Paleo-Indians, there's sort of this debate on hunter-gatherers, if there's equality between the sexes, men and women had sort of divided roles, and yet it said that they were more equal in their tasks. But if we back up to Paleo-Indians, how did Paleo-Indians develop into complex societies?
Oh, they developed Paleo-Indian. That's even before the development of villages. First, you have settled life of some kind. And in South America, that includes people who live more and more permanent settings. Sometimes that has to do with how resources are spread out on the landscape, that in band societies where resources are distributed across the landscape unevenly, people had to move from one place to another. And then when people have enough resources or can create them, then they can stay in one place. And there are advantages to staying in one place, particularly for women and children. So that goes to the theme you were just talking about, that if you can stay in one place, it's easier on very young children. There's the possibility that people might have more time for food preparation. And apparently, the period of weaning for really young children is a dangerous time. Sometimes it's because they need to make that transition from nursing to eating food. And the question is, what do you do to food to make it so small children can eat? And being in one place gives people time to deal with that. So there's an element where becoming slightly more settled has potential benefits for women and children. Then what I'm talking about is the next step beyond that, when you start having differences in places and differences in status. And there, I'm not sure that there's benefits for women and children. I'd have to think about that for a minute.
So this is great because it talks about all the things we're going to talk about in this podcast, which is the rise of agriculture and domestication of plants and animals and all of those things. Because staying in one place is beneficial in some ways and probably not beneficial in other ways. When you stay in one place and you grow and grow and grow, we're not just talking about the rise of a group of people growing, we're talking about the rise of cultures and languages and art and all of these things that come with culture and are part of complex societies. So before we do that, the reason why that I wanted to bring you on is I've really been studying the Norte Chico, and you're one of the leading experts on this group. So maybe you could give us a background on the area, what a pre-Columbian society is, and who the Norte Chico were.
Sure, I can. The Norte Chico is a region on the coast of Peru, and it's unusual because in a particular area, and this is where four rivers go from the Andes down to the coast. So they go from being relatively high in the mountains down to a very narrow coastal plain and then into the ocean. And this describes the entire coast of Peru, which is about three times the size of California. And there are 50 of these little rivers that go from the Andes to the ocean. However, there's just this one chunk of them where something different happened. So now we're talking about 5,000 years ago, where in this one region, something different happened so that people who were living there, and they lived very close to the rivers because the valleys themselves were not tremendously fertile. They were actually desert, but right along the rivers were fertile zones for cultivation. And then there was very rich fishing right off the coast. And that brings up a really interesting question of how people survived. What did people eat? How did they make a living? Because it's quite clear that from a very early time, people fished, at least from the shore. And we're not as clear about when they started fishing with boats, but we know that there was very, very rich fishing along the shore, especially of very small fish, anchovies, and that there were also shellfish, and that people definitely ate these. We find shell mounds. The other interesting thing that happens around 5,000 years ago is that we find that people both right on the coast and living in these little narrow valleys also started to cultivate plants. One of the interesting things is that very first plants to be cultivated weren't food plants. Everywhere else in the world, the earliest cultivated plants were food plants. And in the Norte Chico and all along the coast of Peru, the earliest cultivation was bottle gourds. So these are, they look like squashes, but they dry into containers. And that's what people used them for. They didn't use pottery. They used gourd containers. And those small gourds could be used for floats on fishing nets. They also grew cotton that apparently was twisted into string that was used to make fishing nets. So the earliest cultivated plants seem to have been used to support fishing industry. And based on the richness of the fish in the coast and the use of these plants, it's been suggested that this was a region where complex society developed based on not cultivating plants, but on the fishing industry primarily. And that's one of the things that drew me into working in this area, because archaeologists have found that all around the world, in all the places that have early civilization, there's agriculture. In China, there is rice agriculture. In the Middle East, there's wheat. In Mexico, there's corn. That there seems to be this association of grain cultivation and the accumulation of surplus production, and that surplus is used to basically pay people to do things for others or to build things. And that's how you get monuments constructed and how you get people to specialize in making crafts. That somewhere along the line, there's this agricultural production greater than what people need to eat. And then that's used to make other things happen. And in the Norte Chico, there's this discussion of whether or not that happened just based on the fishing industry. And when we started out, the prevailing view was that this was unique in all the world. However, as I mentioned right back in the beginning, there are these four river valleys where something different appears to be going on at that very early time, 5,000 years ago. And one of the things that marks that is the building of large monuments, the building of big step-sided pyramids, building of circular plazas that are dug into the ground a small distance, and the placing of upright stones. So there's a whole cultural system of mounds, sunken plazas, and upright stones that is found in this particular area. So then the question is, well, is this the result of a very successful fishing industry that developed the same kind of surplus that you could find with agriculture, and then that same surplus is used to create these other things, that the person with the surplus somehow ends up commissioning people to build structures. Now that's getting away. Then we can come back to why this would happen. But what our research set out to do was to look very closely at these large pyramids and determine whether or not they really were from this early period. And then once we had established that indeed they were 5,000 years old, then the question is, were they part of a society that was based on fish or agriculture or both? And what we found was that there was very extensive agriculture, and so that the idea of a society based on just fishing, which would be unique in the whole world, is really unlikely. It looks like the coast of Peru, like every place else. The shift to social complexity is related to the introduction of agriculture. So then now there's all these other related questions. One of them is, why this particular area of the Norte Chico? Why not all along the coast of Peru, where there were pretty similar conditions? One difference may be that in this Norte Chico region, people first practiced canal irrigation, that you live along these little rivers, and that's where the fertile land is, to have more land and create more surplus. And in this case, we're talking about surplus of cotton, fruits, vegetables, beans, and at some point corn. So we do have the same corn, beans, and squash combination that was the basis of the diet throughout all the Americas. Fish as a source of protein, and then lots of different fruits and vegetables like guavas and different kinds of squashes, berries, something called ground cherries, a bunch of other different plants. But basically, the people were successful in cultivating, and they were successful in implementing irrigation. And that irrigation expanded the area they had planted and expanded what they produced. So now I want to go on to yet another thing, and that's, how does agricultural surplus work? Or even this combination of agricultural surplus and fishing surplus. If you produce a surplus in this kind of society, you can't just save it. It's not like money. When you have an agricultural surplus, you have to give it away or sell it, because otherwise it rots. You can salt fish, you can dry some foods, but basically you have to use them. You can't just store them in a storeroom. And that's something that encourages people to look around and decide what they can do.
So we have all these things happening, the domestication of plants, more developed fishing and agriculture, and that leads to another development, commerce.
Yes.
The development of commerce.
Absolutely. And that's also a source of, it's one of the things that generates inequality, because some people are just sharper traders than others. Some people are better farmers than others. And so you do find
personal wealth varies. And there you get into that question of where were women in all of this? This wasn't a society where they made pottery. They knew about clay. They made clay figurines. Not a lot of them, but some. But they didn't make pottery containers. And that's often seen as an activity of women, although doesn't have to be. They had lots and lots of woven containers, bags. They had woven mats. They had some woven clothing, but it wasn't made on a loom. So it was a little slow process for people to really wear a lot of clothing. But they had a lot of weaving, which again, might or might not have been an activity of women. And then they had food. And so these were, and the exchange of goods is something that we think drew people together. And it's in those spots that people drew together where we believe you have the development of the first monuments.
When you're talking about weaving baskets and mats, I'm thinking of the division of gender roles and women maybe traditionally doing this, but I'm also thinking of all the time it would take. That would take a lot of time to weave. But I think it's telling that you say that as people start to gather and these things are happening, we see monuments start to develop. Now, monuments are not essential, right, to human survival, which is why we don't see monuments that, at least that we know of from the Paleo Indians. Because if you're spending all your time and energy foraging for food, which is going to take up most of your day, you don't really have time to build monuments. When you're not foraging, it frees up a lot of time.
It does. Although it may only have been for a portion of the year. If you were to take exchange of goods as the basis for why people would gather together in a group larger than their village, you could look at it as people are attracted to exchanging goods for things that they don't have or for things that they might not have had success in producing that particular time. But what draws people together? Sure, there's the lure of exchange, but just in general. But there's a lot of other things that can go into that. There's social events. There's things like dance, performances, and then there's religious ritual and religious activities. When we look at these places, the big sites in the Norte Chico are centered around a very large pyramid structure and a sunken plaza. And if you think about performing some kind of activity, a sunken plaza is a great location because there even were some step-sided edges. So it's as though people could approach and they could sit around the edge and they could watch what was going on. And then the way these are organized is that often the circular plaza is at the foot of a very large structure and there's a stairway going up the front of it. So a colleague of mine, Tom Pazorski, years ago talked about the idea that everyone could attend events in this circular plaza, but then there might be other activities for a more select group where you go up the steps of the pyramid where there's a smaller plaza on one of the tiers of the structure. And then that might have been something of a different level or that selected out a certain group of people. And then that happened again at the very top of the pyramid where there was usually an open space and also small enclosed rooms, which could have been for activities that weren't intended for everybody to see. So there's the possibility that belief or shared rituals was one of the things that drew people to come together, and that contributing to the construction of these things could have been part of the events that people participated in. So you're a fisherman, you live on the coast, or you're a farmer and you live in the village. And during your slow season, and there are slow times during the year, you might go to a place where you could meet people from other villages, and you would be participating in rituals, seeing people you know, exchanging information, And we know that, for example, that fishermen detect the onset of an El Nino several months before they start because of changes in the kinds of fish you see in the ocean. So you can see that people, there's a reason for people to go and gather together and do a bunch of things. And one of them could be either making improvements to the area to make it more comfortable to get together and building in a kind of routine and repetition to where people meet, but also then building a structure, building a structure so that with a lot of different groups getting together periodically and each of them contributing, say, a week of labor, you really could end up with a very substantial structure. And it's all created over time by people without there being a big group of slaves or something.
As you're talking about these structures, I find myself sort of slipping into my bias, thinking, oh, how cute. They developed a place where they could entertain and perform, as if these ancient peoples were somehow less intelligent than we are with our advanced technology. And really, it's not about ancient peoples being less sophisticated or less intelligent. They just were building on the human history before them, just like we have. And if we were to place a sapien from that their time into today's society, they would be just as complex and intelligent as we are. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yes, I think you're right that we don't intend to say that there was anything lesser about people at that time. They lived in a time, they knew certain things, they didn't know other things, and they were very creative and capable, because if you think about any of us plunked down in the desert and told to live off the land, it would really put it in perspective.
Yeah, it seems really primitive. Which brings me to another question that I had for you. In talking about the Norte Chico, I always just kind of, when I thought of the ancient Americas, I thought of the Mayans and the Incans. But it's really great to know that there were really advanced civilizations that predate those of what we consider the most advanced civilizations of ancient Americas. But clearly there were others that predated the Mayans and the Incas. So can you tell us how other civilizations might have interacted with the Norte Chico and what we know about that?
It's really interesting to see this, to look at this Norte Chico society, because there certainly seems to have been competition between different locations in the region, which we see because people began to build these pyramids in a number of different places. There's as many as 30 different spots where people built from a single structure or a single circular plaza to several large pyramids, smaller pyramids, two or three circular plazas laid out in a great gigantic U shape. So there's all different sizes of these. And part of that might have been competition between the different groups. Oh, you should come and participate. You should come and be part of our group and do your trade here and come and participate in what we're building. And then somebody else going, oh, well, no, you should come over here. And if this sounds a little bit like modern competition for which shopping mall you should go to, it shows you that people do have a lot in common, even over thousands of years. That's kind of an interesting thought. And at the same time, these are people who didn't think they needed pottery. You know, they had a very, very basic way of life, a very function-oriented way of life. They did have some things from other places, but they were very self-sufficient. There is a little bit of evidence that they traded or that, not that people went all the way to Ecuador and came back, but there is spondylus shell. It's the orange shell of the spiny oyster. It's a tropical species, which is why I say it comes from Ecuador, because the tropical waters end right around the border between Peru and Ecuador. And pieces of this really distinctive colored shell are found in archaeological sites in the Norte Chico region. So we know that somehow people traded, and these are small objects, mostly beads, but a few small other shapes. And we know that those came in through some kind of exchange system. There are some crystals, you know, quartz crystals or fluorite crystals, But these are not that uncommon, as it turns out. And they may be things that people found that were prized rather than things that came from far away. There's a question about whether or not people traded for obsidian, which is naturally occurring volcanic glass that would have come from a long distance, but not enough has been found to really answer the question of whether that was actually going on. So there's not a great deal of faraway contact. There was probably interaction with people higher in the highlands, because some of these coastal valleys have paths that go up into the Andes. So people are likely to have been in touch with their neighbors at higher altitudes. But so far, we haven't found a lot of evidence of what it was they exchanged.
What do we know about women back then? We talk about the birth of inequality forming out of agriculture and complex societies. Do we know anything about inequalities in the Norte Chico?
Honestly, we don't know very much yet. I think that a lot of our assumptions about or a lot of what we see, we're really tempted to put our own image of gender roles on rather than seeing clear evidence of where gender roles were. For example, we know that they made a lot of weaving, and we have found what we believe is a workshop for woven materials, you know, a huge pile of odds and ends of bits left over from weaving of the different raw materials and little twists of string and things. So there's no reason but the problem is we really don't have a gender associated with that. Let's assume that cooking was largely a female practice, but again, we just have the remains of places where people cooked. We have the hearth, we have the little scraps of fishbone and gourd and squash fragments, chili pepper fragments, but we don't have objects that would tell us for sure whether it's men or women. We found a couple of little figurines of animals at other sites. There are male and female figurines that show the women with long hair, but not a lot of other details. So I'm really not able, I can't really give you a lot of detail in terms of how tasks were divided up. We just have that idea that women and children stayed closer to home. But honestly, the data's not really there. There's some really interesting ethnographic data from all over the world that suggests that women collected shellfish, and we find lots and lots of shellfish remains, even at sites that are 20 or 25 kilometers away from the coast. Now, in those places, we know that it's not practical for a person to walk all the way to the coast to get these things. We know that they must have arrived by exchange just because it's impractical for a person to walk all day and then collect something like clams and then walk back. You wouldn't even collect enough to feed yourself for the time you were away. But for people who lived on the coast, there's really interesting ethnographic data from Africa and Australia and, all over the place that suggests that women may have collected clams, mussels, seaweed, and anything else that was edible along the shore where men went fishing.
Yes, that's so interesting because we've talked on the series before about a woman who lived probably 13,000 years ago in the Great Lakes area. And her body had been found with a shell pendant that had come from the coast of Florida. So we know that these sort of trade routes have existed for a long time.
Right. And it's a little hard to assign who was doing what. It's certainly possible to envision it as on the coast, both men and women involved in food production and getting marine foodstuffs. and exchanging them and then going inland to some distance and exchanging them with their farming neighbors. And among their farming neighbors, again, both men and women could be involved in cultivation. Then there's the question of, well, who took the, if cotton was really important as string for making fishing nets, because the most common fish were very small, so you wanted nets. Who made that string out of the cotton? Because you have to at least pick out some of the seeds, and then you have to spin it. And anybody can spin cotton. It's just a question. And so, again, it could be men, women, and it's actually a task that children can learn. So everyone could participate. And until we find some more specific things, like it would be wonderful to come up with a burial that had, say, spinning tools in it or farming implements. But I don't know of anything like that.
If you were to tell us one thing about the civilization that you'd like us to understand, what would that be? Could you articulate that for us?
That this ancient civilization was very successful for a very long period of time. The people of the Norte Chico region built these great big, these huge pyramids, and they devoted almost all of their surplus effort, you know, all of their food surplus seems to have gone to get people to build these things. They didn't have a lot of other crafts. They had, you know, they didn't have elaborate goods. They didn't have elaborate paintings. They didn't have elaborate sculptures. They put everything into building these big structures. And they did that for 1,000 years. And they still changed in ways that moved the center of civilization elsewhere along the coast, further north, further south, inland. This area is tremendously successful between 5,000 years ago and about 3,500 years ago. And yet today, it's virtually unknown. And it goes to show that people can do things and can be very successful, but it always changes. There's always something else. And in this case, this region, these four valleys, were never reoccupied with something bigger. So that it's not like civilization always builds up in a single place. You know, think of the Middle East. We think of the Middle East as having had a civilization for at least the last 10,000 years, just right in that core area. And yet in the Norte Chico region, they had a peak between 5,000 and 3,500 years ago that's never been surpassed since then. And I think that we can find that in other places as well. So this is really a very distinct chapter in the history of the world, but it's not one that continued over right down to the present.
Thank you for that. And this is all so fascinating. And I would like to keep you here and ask you 100 more questions, but I've kept you long enough. So really quick, do you just want to tell us about the projects that you're working on now?
This project has been tremendously interesting because when we started out, we didn't really know what we were going to find. I went into this with this question about, was fishing industry the basis of the development of civilization? Were these sites really old? And I didn't have any idea of what we would find, and it's turned out to be tremendously interesting. But really a drop in the bucket. There are so many sites, and there's so much to find out about. And then talking to you, I realized, for example, how little we know in a concrete way about things like gender roles. And one of the things that I am most satisfied with this project is that it has really drawn people to look at this region. That when we started out, there were a very small number of people looking in this area. And now I feel there's a whole new generation of younger archaeologists who are interested in doing this. My colleague Matthew Piscatelli, who is in the Chicago area, has a project going in the Norte Chico, and he's using technology that we never used. He's using ground penetrating radar, and he's talking about using kites to make maps of these gigantic sites because it's so labor intensive to make maps in the traditional way. So one of the things that I think is the most interesting is that there's so much left to know, but now there's a lot more interest than there was when we started out. And I think that's really a great thing.
That's sort of a microcosm of how civilizations work, right? People do work and they build upon someone else's work and upon someone else's work. And this is how civilizations form. And so I just really appreciate you coming on and talking about this. Like I said, growing up, I never really heard about the Norte Chico. And once I started looking into it, I was just fascinated. And so I really appreciate the work that you and colleagues like Dr. Ruth Salas have been doing to bring this region and this history to further light.
Thank you. And there really are a lot of people involved. You know, I work with my husband, Jonathan Haas. We have a whole bunch. We've worked with a number of different graduate students in the U.S. and in Peru. We have wonderful Peruvian colleagues. And I feel like a lot of times my Latin American colleagues don't get the credit that they deserve for being on the ground all the time. So you're right. There's a lot of people involved, and there's a lot still to be done. So I appreciate talking to you, Lindsay.
Now, Dr. Kramer talks about this in our interview. She talks about how complex societies were good because they allowed for certain things to happen, for people to get together, to develop more advanced technologies, but it also allowed societies to stratify. If the Norte Chico are farming gourds, someone has to farm the gourds while someone is fishing. Which job takes more time and which one has more value in society? Well, the Norte Chico would have decided upon this and given certain credibility to each task, certain rewards for each task, and then things would build out of that. Who would protect those doing the fishing and the farming from other bands who might come and threaten their resources? Maybe an army was developed. Who was in charge of that? Who was in charge of keeping order in the city? All of these things have to be addressed. Historian Jared Diamond claims that the root of poverty and inequality tie into the crops we have been able to produce. In fact, there are those that believe that we were directly farming directly correlates with how societies set up their inequalities. Now, I come from a Mormon background, and I've studied Mormon frontier history, and in my Mormonism, we have a Mormon leader named Brigham Young. He was a frontier prophet of the Mormon Church. He led people for several decades in frontier Utah in the Wild West. One of his dreams or one of his visions was to set up what he called the United Order, this idea that there would be no poverty amongst the people. They would live a system that he called the Law of Consecration. And it's sort of, if you can look at it as an outside perspective, it's, I guess you could call it communism, although that term would offend many Mormons. But what it was is everyone would give up all of their goods, all of their money, all of their wealth, and let it be equally distributed. So Brigham Young decides to try this. He sets up a town called Orderville. And in Orderville, they decide to live the United Order. Now, it only lasts for about 10 years, but what they do is they have families there and they decide to give everyone an equal plot of land, and everyone was going to be given the same amount of clothes. The clothes look the same. The houses look the same. And everyone, the idea was everyone would live the same with no poverty. Unfortunately, something that they didn't really think through until after they were living it is as they were dividing out these plots of land, they realized that some plots of land, even though they were the same square shape for everyone, some plots of land were just inherently better than other plots of land. Some were closer to the river. Some had more rocks in it, made it harder to farm. Some were infested with insects. Right away, there was an inherent inequality in Orderville because of how the land was set up. And just like this, and of course, Orderville doesn't work out. Within 10 years, it dissolves, and people, you know, say it's because of everyone's selfishness. But really, it's something to think about. Is equality even possible because of the way nature works? Historian Jared Diamond claims that the root of poverty and inequality tie directly into the types of crops we've been able to produce. The wealth of America, Diamond argues, lies in the crops that Americans have been able to grow. Now, Jared Diamond has been controversial for his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Some archaeologists don't like it, especially don't like a historian talking about archaeology in this way. Jared Diamond also has gotten lots of well-respected academics and experts to back up his claims. Dr. Louise Martin, who is at the Institute of Archaeology in the University College London, would say this, quote, "What we see happening about 9,000 years ago is a remarkable transformation in the way that humans are interacting with animals. We begin to see a process of animal domestication, by which we mean humans were controlling what they were moving, they were controlling their feeding, and they were controlling their breeding. Instead of having to go out to hunt, you have a dependable meat supply on your hoof, year-round, around your site, rather than being subject to seasonal variations in wild and game. We know that communities which first started to have domestic animals already had cereal crops, so they were cultivators. And the combination of these particular animals and plants becomes an extremely attractive package, in that they're complementary. After the harvest period, animals could be turned out onto the stubble, and they can actually eat the remains of the cereal crop harvest. In their turn, animal dung can be used to provide some sort of fertilizer for the cereal crops as well, the crops. So the whole package, you know, is seen to be mutually beneficial, both for animals and the plants, and of course for the humans. Goats and sheep were the first animals to be domesticated in the ancient world, and were eventually followed by other big farm animals of today. All of them were used at first for their meat, but they could all prove useful in other ways, especially with the invention of the plow. Before the Industrial Revolution, beasts of burden were the most powerful machines on the planet. A horse or an ox harnessed to a plow could transform the productivity of the land, allowing farmers to grow more food and feed more people. In New Guinea and many other parts of the world, people never used plows because they never had animals to pull them." End quote. Okay, so Jared Diamond asserts that America does so well because of what we farm. Now, this is complicated because America, ancient America, wasn't farming the same things that America is farming now. And there's this whole big piece of discussion here about colonization, imperialism, and how white Europeans spent several centuries exploiting the resources of other continents and their farming and reaping the benefits, which plays into the stratification and how farming is affected in this scenario. But as human beings learn to farm certain crops, then they learn to domesticate animals, and the land proves to show inequalities. Tribes in New Guinea have rich, rich, fertile islands, but for centuries, anthropologists and other scientists have seen those living in New Guinea as somehow underdeveloped or uncivilized, because they don't have a lot of the technology that the rest of the world around them has. However, if you look at the resources that are limited to the island, even though it's fertile in some resources, it's not fertile in other areas. So like New Guinea didn't have large farm animals to domesticate, so they weren't able to farm in the same ways. It set them in a different plane than in human technological development, because they just didn't have the same materials to work with. There are nearly 2 million known species of wild animals, but the vast majority have never been farmed. Most insects and rodents are of no practical use to humans, according to Louise Martin, and not worth the effort of farming. Some birds, fish, and reptiles have been domesticated, but most are simply impractical to farm. So are most carnivores, not because they're dangerous, but because you'd have to grow other animals just to feed them. The best animals to farm are large, plant-eating mammals. And over the years, humans have probably tried to domesticate all of them, usually without success. Despite repeated efforts, Africans have never domesticated the elephant. Here's what Jared Diamond says, quote, "I have counted up 148 different species of wild, plant-eating terrestrial mammals that weighed over 100 pounds. But of those 148, the number that has ever been successfully farmed for any length of time is just 14. Goats, sheep, pigs, cows, horses, donkeys, Bactrian camels, Arabian camels, water buffalo, llamas, reindeers, yaks, mithens, and bally cattle. Those are the 14 domestic animals in 10,000 years of domestication. And where did these animals come from? none come from New Guinea or Australia, which shows you that Australia and New Guinea don't have those animals to work with. They couldn't domesticate these animals because they weren't there. So those people living in New Guinea weren't working less or weren't less intelligent. They just didn't have the same resources to work with. So in some ways, they developed ahead, and in other ways, they did not. Still, it shows that almost every single human group that survived long-term started to domesticate plants and then animals. But why would they do this? How would this start to begin with, other than just being smart and paying attention to the land? Well, there are several theories. One is the oasis theory, and this is originally proposed by Raphael Pumpbelly in 1906. This theory sort of goes that as the climate got drier due to the Atlantic Depression shifting northward, communities sort of gathered on oases where they were forced in close association with animals, which were then sort of domesticated naturally with the planting of seeds. However, this theory doesn't have a lot of support today because archaeologists believe that the climate data suggests that regions that were domesticated were actually getting wetter, not drier. So we move on to another theory, the hilly flanks hypothesis, proposed by Robert Braidwood in 1948. And this sort of theory suggests that maybe agriculture begins on the hilly flanks of Taurus and the Zagros Mountains, where the climate was not as dry as the oasis theory had suggested. It was a fertile land and it could support all kinds of animals. Another theory suggests is the feeding model suggested by Brian Hayden and suggests that agriculture was driven by ostentatious displays of power. Maybe someone in a tribe or a group or a band wanted to give an extravagant feast and exert dominance over another band. So this required assembling large groups of food, large quantities of food, which drove agricultural technology. There's the demographic theories by Carl Sauer and Lewis Binford and Kent Flannery, which they believe that as society became increasingly sedentary, they would tap out on the resources in the environment around them. So if a tribe stayed in one place longer, they would run out of resources. And so it required that more food would be gathered, and this would drive the need for food. Then there's the evolutionary intentionality theory, developed by David Rindos and others, which view agriculture as sort of an evolutionary adaptation of plants and humans. Starting with the domestication by protection of wild plants, it led to the specialization of location and then full-fledged domestication. So as people started to value plants, they would sort of ritualize them, try to protect them, and out of this, they learned how the plants worked. Anyway, there are more and more theories of why this starts, but we do know that it starts and that women possibly had a role to play in this. As it starts, people settle down and they start farming food. But the Neolithic Revolution involved far more than the adoption of a limited set of food-producing techniques. It would transform small bands of hunter-gatherers into sedentary villages and towns. People would stop traveling. They would stop moving their group from place to place, and they would just settle down in one village or town. And of course, this would radically modify their natural environment. And they were forced somehow to cultivate crops, develop irrigation, figure out how to water the crops, really put their brains to use. It would provide densely populated settlements like complex societies like Winifred Kramer talked about. And as this happens, as societies are gathering together, labor is starting to be divided. This leaves less and less jobs for everyone. And we see the development of non-portable art and architecture, centralized administrations and political structures. We see hierarchical ideologies. We see systems of knowledge like writing and property ownership, private property, personal land ownership, class struggles, and armies. The idea of stratification, the birth of inequality, is what scholars believe is the net negative of the agricultural revolution. You streamline labor, and then you find a way to sit on top of it and not have to do the labor yourself while reaping the benefits. How does this happen? According to Sapiens writer Noah Harari, you tell myths. Here's what Harari says. Scholars once proclaimed that the agricultural revolution was a great leap forward for humanity. They told a tale of progress fueled by human brain power. Evolution gradually produced even more intelligent people. Eventually, people were so smart that they were able to decipher nature's secrets, enabling them to tame sheep and cultivate wheat. As soon as this happened, they cheerfully abandoned their grueling, dangerous, and often Spartan life of hunter-gatherers, settling down to enjoy the pleasant, satiated life of farmers. That tale is a fantasy. There is no evidence that people became more intelligent with time. Foragers knew the secrets of nature long before the agricultural revolution, since their survival depended on an intimate knowledge of the animals they hunted and the plants that they gathered. Rather than heralding a new era of easy living, the agricultural revolution left farmers with lives generally more difficult and less satisfying than those of foragers. Hunter-gatherers spent their time in more stimulating and varied ways and were less in danger of starvation and disease. Harari is saying that living in the agricultural sort of farming lifestyle was more dangerous, was more boring, was more hard on your body, that it was a lot better to be in a hunter-gatherer society. He goes on to say that agricultural revolution certainly enlarged the sum total of food at the disposal of humankind, but the extra food did not translate into better diet or more leisure. Rather, it translated into population explosions and pampered elites. The average farmer worked harder than the average forager and got a worse diet in return. The agricultural revolution was history's biggest fraud. Who was responsible? Neither kings, nor priests, nor merchants. The culprits were a handful of plant species, including wheat, rice, and potatoes. These plants domesticated Homo sapiens, rather than vice versa. Think for a moment about the agricultural revolution from the viewpoint of wheat. 10,000 years ago, wheat was just a wild grass, one of many confined to a small range in the Middle East. Suddenly, within just a few short millennia, it was growing all over the world. According to the basic evolutionary criteria of survival and reproduction, wheat has become one of the most successful plants in the history of the earth. In areas such as the Great Plains of North America, where not a single wheat stalk grew 10,000 years ago, you can today walk for hundreds upon hundreds of miles without encountering any other plant. Worldwide, wheat covers about 870,000 square miles of the globe's surface, almost 10 times the size of Britain. How did this grass turn from insignificance to ubiquitous? Wheat did it by manipulating Homo sapiens to its advantage. This ape had been living a fairly comfortable life, hunting and gathering until about 10,000 years ago, but then began to invest more and more effort into cultivating wheat. Within a couple of millennia, humans in many parts of the world were doing little from dawn to dusk other than taking care of wheat plants. It wasn't easy. So this developing of wheat plants, if it's true that wheat domesticated us, not the other way around, there is a good argument for it. Reaping the fields was backbreaking effort. Wheat was hard to grow. It didn't like sharing space, water, and nutrients with other plants. So men and women would have to labor in the scorching sun day after day to weed it, to water it, to feed it. They would have to dig irrigation canals or lug heavy containers or buckets to water it. Our bodies were not developed for this kind of work. We were runners. We were gatherers. We were adapted to climbing apple trees and chasing after gazelles, not clearing rocks and carrying water buckets. Harari says human spines, knees, necks, and arches paid the price. Studies of ancient skeletons indicate that the transition to agriculture brought about a plethora of ailments, such as slip discs, arthritis, and hernias. Moreover, the new agricultural task demanded so much time that people were forced to settle permanently next to their wheat fields. This completely changed their way of life. We did not domesticate wheat. It domesticated us. The word domesticate comes from Latin domus, which means house. Who's living in the house? Not the wheat. It's the sapiens. Wheat did not give people economic security. The life of a peasant is far less secure than the life of a hunter-gatherer. Foragers relied on dozens of species to survive and could weather difficult years even without stocks of preserved food. If they didn't have food, they could travel on and find it somewhere else. If the availability of one species was reduced, they could gather and hunt more of the species somewhere else. Farming societies, however, were really stuck with what they got. In many areas, they just relied on a single staple, such as wheat, potatoes, or rice. And if those failed because of the weather or insects or fungus, people could die by the thousands and sometimes even millions. And we didn't offer security against human violence either. Farmers were basically sitting ducks for anyone to attack. They spent their days laboring in the fields, not training, and not worrying about protection. They had big crops that could be burned easily, and if their crops burned, that meant they were starved. They were vulnerable. When a foraging band was attacked by a stronger rival, it could usually just run away or move on. It was difficult and dangerous, no doubt, but it was feasible. If a stronger rival attacked a farmer group, they could set it on fire and leave and add destruction for years. Back to Harare. With the move to permanent villages and the increase in food supply, the population began to grow. Giving up the nomadic life enabled women to have a child every year. Babies were weaned at an earlier age. They could be fed on porridge and gruel. The extra hands were sorely needed in the fields. But the extra mouths quickly wiped out the food surpluses, so even more fields had to be planted. As people began living in these disease-ridden settlements, as children fed more on cereals and less on mother's milk, and as each child competed for his or her porridge with more and more siblings, child mortality soared. In most agricultural societies, at least one out of every three children died before reaching 20. Yet the increase in births still outpaced the increase in deaths as humans kept having larger numbers of children. Harari argues that people were trapped because of this, that this trapped them in a sedentary lifestyle that made them more vulnerable to death and disease. But because they didn't know better, because they miscalculated what this would mean, it seemed more stable to be able to manipulate the land. It seemed like a better idea to not have to move. It seemed more luxurious to be able to set up a shelter that you could add upon and build upon and not have to pack up and go. And maybe you didn't realize that you're getting less calories than your grandparents did who were foragers. Maybe it seemed like your life was more advanced. It would take generations for small changes to accumulate and transform these societies. But by then, nobody would remember that they had ever lived differently. And like Harari said, if the adoption of plowing increased a village's population from 100 to 110, which 10 people would have volunteered to starve so that the others could go back to the good old times? There was no going back. The trap was shut. It was a pursuit for what they saw was an easier life, but it actually resulted in a lot more hardship. And you know, this happens to us today. This idea that if you work hard and you go to college and you go to the right schools, that life is going to be easier for you, but by the time you're midlife, you're trapped with a mortgage and a marriage and children and a house in the city that needs two cars to go anywhere, and you have bills that you have to pay and loans that you have to pay off and a job that you have to work hard at to do so. Are you supposed to dig up and go back to your roots and live a nomadic lifestyle? Of course not. It would be nearly impossible. Harari says one of history's few iron laws is that luxuries tend to become necessities and to spawn new obligations. Once people get used to a certain luxury, they take it for granted. Then they begin to count on it. Finally, they reach a point where they can't live without it. Over the last few decades, we've invented countless time-saving devices that are supposed to make life more relaxed. Washing machines, vacuum cleaners, dishwashers, telephones, mobile phones, computers, emails. Previously, it took a lot of work to write a letter, address, stamp, and an envelope, and take it to the mailbox. It took days or maybe weeks. Maybe even months to get a reply. Nowadays, you can dash off an email, send it halfway across the globe, and if your addressee is online, receive a reply a minute later. You saved all that trouble and time, but do you have a more relaxed life? Sadly not. Back in the snail mail era, people usually only wrote letters when they had something important to relate. Rather than writing the first thing that came into their heads, they considered carefully what they wanted to say and how to phrase it. They expected to receive a similarly considered answer. Most people wrote and received no more than a handful of letters a month and seldom felt compelled to reply immediately. Today, we receive dozens of emails each day, all from people who expect a prompt reply. We thought we were saving time. Instead, we revved up the treadmill of life to 10 times its former speed and made our days more anxious and agitated. Harari thinks the agricultural revolution was a luxury trap that set us down a road to the lie of a more relaxed, peaceful life. Is he right? Is that where we're at? Did the domestication of plants and animals lead to more inequality in human beings? Did it set up systems of power that we are unable to escape? It's very possible. So if you were to choose, if you could theoretically go back to your roots, to your ancient ancestors' roots, would you do it? Would you live a life running away from saber-toothed tigers and hunting small game, gathering for half your day, and then sitting around the fire draped in old animal clothes in shelters that you would pick up and move shortly? Would you do that rather than the life you live today? It's an interesting question. Thanks for listening to another Story of Woman podcast. The Story of Woman podcast is produced by Lindsay Hanson Park. We are generously sponsored by Bluehost and Bluehost.com. Bluehost is one of the largest and most trusted web hosting services, powering millions of websites. If you go and get on Bluehost right now, you can get a free domain name. The web art is designed by Geraldine Hassel-Poole, with the music provided generously by Lady Murasaki. Check them out at ladymurasaki.bandcamp.com. If you like what you heard today, consider a donation at storywoman.org.